So, Berto, have you seen the new movie, The Girl on the Train?
Gone Girl? Oh, yes. Wait. The Girl on the Gone? The yeah. Gone Train?
The Girl yes. on the Gone Train.
I have seen it.
So, let's talk about that. What do you say?
Let's do it.
This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I am chair of the Couple and Family Therapy Program at Antioch University, Seattle, and I'm also a licensed marriage and family therapist.
My name is Humberto Castañeda, and I repair model trains.
Today, I want to get into as much psychology as we can regarding this movie. We're also going to talk about the entire storyline, so spoiler alert.
Spoilers!
If you haven't seen the movie yet, I recommend seeing it. It's not bad. I'd give it a 5 or 6 out of 10. It's worth it. Probably a rental at the very least.
It's not as good as Gone Girl, but it's good.
Right.
It's not bad.
Right. It's not stylized like Gone Girl.
Yeah.
And it's not as impactful.
Yeah.
But it's a good story. I thought, you know, a good classic mystery kind of story.
Yeah.
And also just a little bit of a spoiler to this episode is I want to get into the memory and the depiction of memory and the depiction of memory loss and memory recovery. And what I'm going to talk about later is basically the way that the movie portrays it is mostly false. But I'll get into more of that later.
Mostly.
So The Girl on the Train book. Did you know the book was just published last year?
Yeah. Yeah. So actually, they auctioned the rights for the movie before the book was published.
Whoa.
Yeah. Because they... She had published a whole bunch of kind of fluffy romance novel, well, not even romance novels, just like fluffy. They call them chiclet novels under a pseudonym, and then she was like, "Okay, I guess I'll try this other route." And they sent the script or they sent the early draft to some producer or something. They're like, "Ooh, I want this." Wow. So they auctioned the movie before the book was even, I think before it was even finished.
Yeah. I wonder if it's one of those things where, you know, the Deep Impact and The Day After phenomenon where it's like Gone Girl and The Girl on the Train, you know, two different studio houses.
Could be, yeah.
Will think the same story, you know, try to make the same.
Yeah, maybe because Gone Girl came out how long ago?
Last year,
was
just
it?
A year ago.
So maybe it could have been one of those things where, ooh, that did well. Do we have others like that? Ooh, look at this. Look
but
at this book.
If you're saying that they bought it before it was published,
yeah.
It probably was before.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyway.
That's true.
British author Paula Hawkins. It was a New York Times fiction bestseller for 13 consecutive weeks.
So it wasn't really a bestseller?
It was the bestseller in the fiction category. It occupied the number one spot in the UK hardback book chart.
That sounds dirty.
For 20 weeks, which is the longest any book has ever been number one, which means it beat Harry Potter and all those other books, which is interesting.
That's crazy.
Okay, so mainly what we're going to talk about today is the adaptation, but I heard that it's actually pretty close to the book.
I don't know if you want to talk about it later, but there are some key differences from what I understand.
Okay, so you can sprinkle that in.
Okay.
Adaptation a year later, we just saw it, 2016. The key differences that I immediately saw was that instead of it being set in London and England, it's set in New York City or New York State. But they have a British lead,
right.
An English lead, and everyone else is supposed to be American or Canadian. You don't know.
I don't know that the setting matters too much in the end, especially if you haven't read. Like, if you read the book, you might be attached to that setting.
Yeah.
But if you haven't, I don't know that the setting really makes
No, it doesn't make any difference at all. But why not make it in London?
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, why change it? It's just an example, I think, of just how stupid Americans are when it comes to this sort of thing. It's like, unless the story has an American major element, they won't go see it, or they won't think people will go see it. You know, it's like how Narcos, this story isn't about Colombia.
That's true.
It's about this American blonde-haired, blue-eyed guy who goes to Colombia.
Which is the true star of the whole
thing. You know, 7 years in Tibet is not about Tibet and not about the Dalai Lama, but about this Aryan German who's played by Brad Pitt and goes to Tibet. It's always the same thing. It always drives me
crazy.
It's
like there's a scandal with the new Bruce Lee movie coming out, The Birth of the Dragon or something like this.
No, you're not Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
I thought you were talking about Mulan, because they're making a live action. They're making a live action with Mulan, and Disney was going to have the main lead guy, an American guy.
Oh, I didn't hear that. No, this is a a new movie that's coming out very soon or something about like Bruce Lee's early years in the States. But apparently the main character isn't Bruce Lee. It's like some white dude or something.
Yeah.
So there was another kind of scandal.
About it drives me crazy. This happens all the time. And it's stupid. People...
David Carradine.
either the studios are stupid or the audience is stupid or everyone's stupid. I don't know. But it drives me... Like, for instance, the best movie about... Or the most well-produced, most expensive movie about the internment camps, which my family was imprisoned during World War II.
The Japanese internment.
They were American citizens born in the United States, born in the fucking United States, imprisoned by our government during World War II for no reason. And meanwhile, there's millions of Germans, you know, actually doing espionage in the United States.
Well, I mean, if there's a poison Skittle and you're trying to eat a bag of Skittles, you know.
Right. Just imprison all the Skittles. And there's only been one movie. And of course, it's from a white guy's perspective who falls in love with a Japanese girl. It's mainly about, Ethan Hawke and him.
Wow.
It's actually Snow Falling as Cedars, this book. And it's actually about Bainbridge Island, which is nearby here.
Oh, wait. That's the book?
Yeah.
And that's about the internment camps?
Yeah.
Oh, I never knew that.
Oh.
I never watched or read, but I've heard good things about it.
Yeah, well. So, okay. Produced by Mark Platt. Do you know what else he produced?
No.
Mark Platt. Legally Blonde.
What?
Josie and the Pussycats. He produced Wanted. Do you know Wanted, the movie?
Oh, yes. Ugh.
I kind of liked it. It was okay.
No. No, especially if you've read the graphic novel.
Yeah, I'm sure. Just like... Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
That one was pretty good.
That's a great... Also based on a comic. Drive. He produced Drive.
All right. That was good.
Into the Woods.
Oh, that was good, too. That was good.
Bridge of Spies.
I haven't seen that.
It's okay. Mary Poppins, which is coming out in 2018. Mary Poppins.
It's a new Mary Poppins?
Return, yeah.
Oh.
And a Wicked movie.
Oh, depends. I hope it's the Broadway version, not the book.
And The Little Mermaid. There's a new Little Mermaid movie coming out.
Oh, what? A live action?
I don't know.
Is this what we come to? Like, okay, guys, we're fully out of ideas.
Totally.
What do we do?
Absolutely. Directed by Tate Taylor. He's a newish director. He directed The Help.
Oh, that was a lauded film, right?
Like, yeah. Have you seen it?
No.
Yeah. I mean, it's touching, but it's not
Wasn't it nominated or something?
Yeah, okay. But it's not very sophisticated. Again, from the perspective of a white woman. Okay, the whole movie is about black people in the South.
During slavery?
I think it's during the 60s.
Oh, okay.
And essentially it's like slavery 2.0, you know, where the black women in the South are the help in these white rich houses. And of course, it's told from Emma Watson's Emma Stone's perspective. Emma Stone, isn't that her name?
I have no idea.
Anyway, same thing with that new movie from the guy who made Elizabethtown and Almost Famous.
Which movie?
Cameron Crowe. The one in Hawaii. Again, because they're making a movie about Hawaii, okay?
Oh.
And, we got to get an Asian American, a Hawaiian person in there. So let's get Emma Stone,
this
blonde, blue-eyed girl, to play a quarter Japanese girl.
Oh, man.
Now, I have quarter Japanese nieces and nephews who are blonde-haired, blue-eyed. So that's not unheard of. But, again, if you're trying to... make a movie about Hawaii.
Right.
And the leads are blonde and blue white. Because I think the lead was, what's his face? God, I forget it. I always forget that guy's name. Anyway.
From Matthew McConaughey or something?
No. Oh, man. Okay. Anyway.
But they're not Hawaiian looking.
No.
And this is, that's sad because I love Cameron Crowe.
Yeah.
I bet you the soundtrack's going to be kick-ass.
But has he made a good movie in the last 10 years?
Well, has he made a movie in the last 10
years? Yeah, he's made a couple movies. I could look it up. But anyway, Tate Taylor, he made The Help. He also made Get On Up, the James Brown biopic, as you would call it, and as I used to call it. Stars Emily Blunt, who's married to Jim from The Office. Did you know he's married to...
Yeah, oh yeah. Oh yeah.
And she used to date Michael Bublé.
She's a lucky girl.
Yeah. They seem like actually a great couple.
Yeah.
She was in The Devil Wears Prada, Charlie Wilson's War.
Wait, Emily Blunt was in The Devil Wears Prada?
Apparently. Maybe a small part.
Whoa.
But the first movie I saw her in was Sunshine Cleaning. That's
yeah.
Movie that I really remember.
That's
she,
good.
She was the Queen Victoria and the Young Victoria. She was in The Wolfman. Do you remember seeing Wolfman? In the theater,
oh,
you and
yes.
me?
Oh,
you
yes.
You hated that. I liked it. I liked it.
No.
The Adjustment Bureau. She was in Looper.
Looper, right.
The Wind Rises, which is the Japanese cartoon. She's a voice.
By the way, when the movie started...
Which movie?
The...
Wolfman?
No, the one we're talking about. Gone Girl 2.
Yeah.
The Girl on the Train. When the movie started, they had just played a preview for the new Mr. and Mrs. Smith movie with Brad Pitt and Marion Cotillard.
Girl. Yeah.
And so when the movie started and I saw Emily Blunt, I didn't connect who she was at first, and I thought it was Marion Cotillard.
Oh.
Because there's a resemblance there.
Because all white people look the same?
Yeah, yeah.
She was also in Edge of Tomorrow, which I love. I love
yeah,
that
I
one.
Really like that one.
She was in Into the Woods and Sicario. Have you seen that movie yet?
No.
My
I
God.
I know. I'm missing out. I can't
it's
believe
it.
It's
one of the best movies in the past 10 years, I'm telling you.
I know. I have to watch it. I'm sure I will love it.
And she's going to play somewhat a voice in a cartoon, My Little Pony.
What they're making? Wait. They're making like a full feature length?
Next year.
Because I love My Little Pony, man.
Okay.
I'm turning bronyish, sort of.
Okay. Well, I think by
turning
definition...
Turning bronyish, I'm turning bronyish.
You're already...
I really think so.
Yeah. And, of course, Justin Theroux is Tom.
Yeah.
Married to Jennifer Aniston.
From American Psycho.
American Psycho. He was in I Shot Andy Warhol, which is
a
great movie. He was in Romy and Michelle's High School Reunion.
I did see that.
Great movie. Then he was in American Psycho, which, of course...
And he's in the... Left Behind, is
yeah,
it?
He's in that TV show. Mulholland Drive, Charlie's Angels, The Baxter.
Oh my God, he was in Mulholland Drive.
Yeah, totally.
I totally forgot about that.
Yeah, it's a great movie. That's part, it might be one of my favorite David Lynch movies. He's in the Baxter, which is a great, great movie. Miami Vice, Inland Empire, not a great movie, but you know, it's when David Lynch started to lose his...
I like him. I like Justin Theroux.
Yeah. Tropic Thunder. He was also the writer and executive producer of Tropic Thunder. Which is,
what?
Yeah. He was the writer of Iron Man 2.
Wait. Who was?
Justin Theroux.
He didn't write Iron Man 2, did he?
Yeah. Or one of the writers.
He's a writer?
Yeah. Megamind. He was an executive producer of Megamind.
Oh, my God. I have so much
he was
new admiration.
One of the writers of Rock of Ages, and he's... at least one of the writers of Zoolander 2.
Yeah, I have a full man crush on this guy now.
Okay, story. Let's get into it. So I'm just going to talk mainly about Rachel and Megan's storyline because the movie lays it out in a non-sequential manner, you know, the full story. And so I'm just going to walk us through a timeline to kind of analyze these characters.
Which, by the way, one of the changes is, from my understanding between the book and the movie, is that in the book, there was a lot more... It was a lot more the story of three women.
Yeah.
Whereas in the movie, it's kind of the story of one woman with a couple of side characters.
Right. I think it has all three women, it says it from their point of view.
Yeah.
Kind of like Game of Thrones, or I think Gone Girl was told in a similar way, you know, where it was from his point
of
view.
That's true, yeah.
And then from her point of view. Okay. So Rachel, she's the main character. Rachel, we don't see this in the movie or I think in the book, but Rachel gets married to Tom. She has the perfect husband and the perfect house, and she decorates the house, and it's this beautiful home.
They seem wealthy, right?
Like, yes.
These are wealthy houses.
People are always wealthy in the movies.
That's true.
I mean, that house is probably $3-4 million.
That's true.
I mean, it's like right, you know, on the ocean or, you know, the train's going by. There's no house, but, you know.
And unless the movie is about it, you never see them struggling financially in the least.
No. People, actually, I'm not the first person to point this out. There's whole pieces on this that... Even in sitcoms, when people are playing poor people, if you really just analyze the property that they're living in, they're usually multi-million-dollar homes. You know, like they never show people living in actual shitty apartments that, you know, because just think about.
That wouldn't film very well.
Right. Because just think about the apartments you and I have lived in our lifetime.
Right.
And even the mid-range ones are way shittier than the shittiest version of a house you've ever seen, particularly in these kinds of movies.
Wasn't like the Friends apartment, like wouldn't that There was this thing about like, it'd be worth so much money.
Exactly. It's probably $5 million. It's like a loft. It's up. It has a view. It has a deck. It's humongous.
You can see naked people from your window.
Yeah. By the way, I recently watched a couple old episodes of Friends, and those six are basically supermodels. They, but aside from Chandler, who's also very good looking, all of them, even...
that's true.
Even what's-his-face...
Phoebe.
No, the other...
Ross.
Ross. Even he is just a... I mean, all six of them are strikingly good-looking people.
That's true.
And when I was watching it in the 90s, I never thought about it.
I didn't think of that either.
But if you look at them now, especially... I mean...
I always thought of Courtney Cox as like, oh, she's great-looking. And I liked Rachel. She was my favorite.
Yeah.
But that was... And then I thought, what's Joey? Oh, he's kind of, he's cute guy, you know?
But if you just watch an episode, like watch him in, you know, as they move around in the world, like they're just, all six of them just incredibly attractive people. And I think it still holds up. I think it's still a pretty funny show. I mean, you know, it's usually based on pretty, you know, silly premises. But anyway, okay. Rachel marries Tom. She has the perfect life. And she, but she finds out that she can't have kids.
Right.
And this is a major part of the story here because it kind of sets up every, there's a few key traumas that happen in these people's lives. And this is the key for her. They can't have kids. And it's a long, difficult process of her trying to have kids and not, you know, not being out with the kids. So can you see how this might traumatize somebody, Berto? What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you're invested in that and that's, you know, you've mentally grown up with a career path, so to speak, about your life. And if one of those things is, oh, you know, and I'll get married and I'll have kids. And you get to that point in your life and you're like, okay, well, it's time to have kids. And, oh, it's not working. Well, let's try again. Oh, it's still not working. Is there something wrong with me? You know, I mean, that's got to be really, really hard to deal with.
Right. So she becomes depressed. She starts drinking a lot to cope, and she often blacks out from drinking, even while she's married to Tom.
One thing that was unclear to me is if she... Well, two things that were unclear to me was they made it look in the memory, and of course the memories were shown to be unreliable, but they made it look like he was supportive through the process of trying to have children.
Right.
In the one scene they showed him, he seemed supportive. And, but we don't know if he was already maybe cheating or things like that. And then two, I didn't know if she started drinking before she found out about the cheating.
Right. There's a lot of uncertainty, and I don't think the book necessarily fleshes all that out either. Okay. But at the very least, she developed a drinking problem at some point. But I think they intimated that it started when she was having trouble. Yeah, because her life was going well up until that point.
Okay.
Her husband leaves her at this point, and she blames herself because she can't have kids. She blames herself for drinking a lot. She blames herself for what she thinks is she was a perpetrator of violence.
That's right.
Tom convinces her, you know, when she wakes up in the morning, it's like...
And this is one of the twists.
Yeah. You were violent with me last night when, in fact, Tom was violent with her, and she might have been trying to defend herself, and then... But she's so drunk, she blacked out, and then he would manipulate her to think that she was the, you know, and...
By the way, that was one of the really effective moments in the movie for me.
Yeah.
Like, there are things I didn't quite care so much for, but the moment where she's talking to Phoebe, I don't know her character's name, but Phoebe from Friends, and you have that kind of reveal where what she remembers of her monstrosity was totally not right.
Right.
That was really powerful.
Yeah. I did not see that coming.
Right.
That was a pretty effective storytelling.
Yeah. And I think part of it is they actually did a good job in making her sympathetic in spite of those memories where she seemed monstrous.
Right.
Like, I was already feeling sympathy for her. And then all of a sudden, it's like, oh my God, I feel so sorry for you.
Well, we have to take a break. And when we get back, we will continue this discussion. What do you say?
Let's take a break.
Okay, so we're back, but before we get into the analysis here, I just want to announce to everyone that we have a sponsor. It's our first sponsor, Loot Crate. What do you know about Loot Crate, Berto?
you're a kid at heart, right?
Yeah.
I'm a kid at heart.
Star Wars.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And so, but you know, nowadays, you're an adult, you might be a little busy, maybe you're in school, maybe you got a lot of classes. And so, when do you get chances to go downtown, go to the mall, go to toy stores, and find cool stuff for yourself from all the things that you actually care about? Oh. You don't have this kind of time.
Yeah.
So, Loot Crate steps in to solve that problem, my friend. Wow. Basically, once a month, I think it's once a month, right? You'll get like this, like Loot Crate, like in video games, you know, like when you like find a thing, you open it and ta-da-da-da-da, right? Yeah. With like all sorts of cool goodies about like movies and video games and comics and things that are like really neat. And they're rare, like not, there's sometimes these are items that you can only get through this service too.
And you can choose different genres. You can choose like comics or Star Wars or, you know, it's October now, so it's Halloween. And there's various different options you can choose from.
That's right.
So, and Brito, you're a born salesman. I'm personally sold. We did not prepare for this. If you listened to the last time I talked about this, it was just me by myself. I like totally stumbled my way through that conversation. It was ridiculous. But anyway,
I'm not only a customer, I'm also a client.
Oh, so if you go to lootcrate.com and you use the promo code psychology, it's psychology, people, use that code. I'm 95% sure you get a discount. And I know for sure we get a kickback of about $20 for every person who signs up. So
do they have action figures of us?
They should.
They should.
They should, yeah. You kind of look like Poe from...
oh, that's true. I could be Poe.
And I look like every Asian. Okay, so let's get back into it here. All right, so Rachel, she gets fired because of her drinking, so her life is really going down the tubes. And she just rides the train to and from London.
And she's been out of work for a year.
Right.
By the way, this is another one of those. I guess maybe in London you can do it because I think they have the dole, right? Like you get free money from the government.
Well, she's living with her friend.
Yeah.
And she's basically sleeping on her couch for free.
Yeah.
Okay. But it's like, yeah, but how does she afford?
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And this leads me to the second thing that I heard was different from the book that is sort of significant. Apparently in the book, the character, Rachel, is very frumpy. Overweight. She's gained weight and she looks terrible. Her clothes are too small because she can't afford new clothes and she's grown heavier than she was when she bought those clothes. And she's just a mess, which by the way makes a lot more sense when that scene in the movie when the guy said the husband of the other girl says to her, I would never date someone like you or something like that. Because
right.
Emily Blunt is a pretty good looking gal,
right.
Even when they make her look sort of alcoholic.
Yeah, that's another thing in the movies that they never get quite right, because you remember the girl, the American actress who plays a British girl, it's a comedy, there's a new one coming out where she has a baby.
Yeah,
the Bridget Jones Diary
thing, yeah.
She in the first movie, she's supposed to be fat and ugly,
right.
And it's she's not fat.
No,
she's not.
She weighs like 5 more pounds than she's supposed to.
You know, on average to American men and women, she's pretty thin at the time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, yeah, it's another one of those things in movies that I'm sure they start out and go, oh, maybe we should really make it authentic. And then they really just kind of gravitate toward the mean. Anyway. So she rides the train to and from London or New York, depending on your venue here. And while looking at these houses where she actually used to live, she sees this neighborhood. She sees Megan and Scott, whom she doesn't know. And she sees they're this beautiful couple. And she sees Megan. She says, oh, she's everything I want to be. And she creates this fantasy life. She calls them in the book, she calls them like Jess. She like makes up names for them that aren't their real names. And she has this total fantasy life for this couple. And, you know, because she's depressed and she's an alcoholic and she just rides the train for no reason. and so she escapes into this fantasy life of these people. Presumably also she's looking out at the window to see if she can see her ex-husband.
Because it's right next to the house that she used to live in.
Right.
Yeah.
So this is where I could get into a little bit of analytic stuff here, is that when we are suffering from pain in our mind or psychic pain, we will resort to different defense mechanisms to protect ourselves from that pain. So the pain she's suffering from is just tremendous amount of self-loathing and self-reproach and guilt and self-esteem problems. And it's all my fault. I was the one who drank. I pushed my husband away. If it wasn't for me being a loser, I'd still have that life. Well, one of the things that people will resort to is that we need to have a good aspect of ourself. We need to believe in a good aspect of ourself, right?
Right.
Everyone needs to have self-esteem. We also recognize at times that there's bad things about us, right? Well, when all we can see is bad things about us, we actually believe, and this is a psychoanalytic concept, that we cannot hold on to the good aspects of ourselves within ourselves, because we believe that we will destroy that. The overwhelming bad part of us will destroy any good in us that's possibly there. So what we will do is we will idealize other people.
I see.
We will put our good aspects into someone else. We'll idealize another human being. In that way, it's putting our good qualities safely in someone else. And then we watch that other person very intently, usually from afar, because the closer we get, the more we realize you can't idealize somebody. But you can idealize someone from afar, and in so doing, you can protect the good aspects of yourself by depositing them in someone else. Does that make sense?
Oh, interesting.
So that's one idea. Also, fantasy can be a defense against pain. So she loses herself in this fantasy world, and she makes up these names for this couple, and she idealizes them.
And it becomes an occupation.
Yeah.
So she can kind of feel like she's doing something productive when she's not really.
Right. And actually, as I say this, I didn't know that this author actually wrote romance novels. It kind of makes you wonder about the author and how she might lose herself in fantasy,
right.
what she's trying to deny or something, right? Because essentially that's what she does, right?
That's true.
She writes stories about beautiful people and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so in the movie, I don't know if in the book, but in the movie they show Rachel having a lot of rage. She has moments of rage, like when she's in the bathroom. And she has elaborate fantasies about killing Tom. And you know, which is actually more common than we'd like to think. Have you ever experienced this in the real world? People having elaborate fantasies of wanting to hurt,
like exes, or
yeah, someone who's been humiliated or cheated on or harmed or something, and or broken up with, and they.
Well,
have.
I guess not directly. You hear enough things online, but...
Well, I have. Lots of clients will talk about this. Maybe they, I don't know, just feel more comfortable to tell their therapist and not their friends would be my guess. But I've actually experienced it so often that I've come to consider it just a normal part of difficult breakups. If you're the one being dumped, it's a maybe even a biological thing.
Oh, my God. What am I talking about? I'm sitting here like, yeah, no, I've never, my parents.
Oh, really?
When my mom left, my dad was so enraged. And I would go as far as to say that maybe even to this day, he probably harbors fantasies of retribution.
Right. And we get alarmed by that because we watch a lot of stupid news stories where people actually carry out on these thoughts. Or movies where people, but the vast majority of people that have those fantasies don't ever act on them.
Right,
they're seemingly a normal part of grief and of recovery from a breakup like that. And I've actually worked with people I don't actively encourage these thoughts, but I encourage them to discuss them with me, which means that they might go into detail about the thoughts that go on in their head.
Scary.
It is scary, but over time, I'm completely unscared of them because it's just so common. And no one has ever acted on them.
And then unfortunately, the one in 1 million time that someone acts on it, you couldn't have seen it coming because they all said the same thing.
Right. Yeah. And everyone thinks when they sit down on my couch and talk about it that they are perhaps one of those 1 in a million people. And I reassure them and I say, well, do you think you're actually going to do it? And they'll say, no, I, I, I could never do something like that, but I have these thoughts. And does that mean I'm crazy? And I'm like, no, it's just a normal part of you know, it's a normal part of recovery. And it can last for a long time. Like in the case with your dad, it might last for decades. But
if it goes unresolved, yes.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I think that it's tempting even as a clinician to say there's a time limit on this sort of thing. But the more I study human beings and the more I look at the research, the more I realize that grief and recovery from these events might not ever fully resolve. Mm-hmm. You know, they can be so difficult. Of course, we always want to seek resolution and moving on, so to speak. But for some people, it can be so intense and so difficult that they never really do.
Right.
Okay. So Rachel seemingly is calling and texting Tom, and Anna, who is Tom's new wife, is noticing these texts and calls.
And they're like nonstop.
Right. And Rachel thinks that it's her because she drinks to blackout frequently.
Yeah.
And so everyone thinks that it's Rachel, but it's not Rachel calling. It's actually Megan calling and texting during some of this time.
And
when we find out about that later,
is she using Rachel's name or something?
I think, no, it's like, remember, it was like, no, it's like a blocked number or something.
Oh, got it.
And so Anna sees blocked number and she's like, oh, of course it's Rachel.
I forgot about that. Right. Yeah.
Okay. So one day while drunk, Rachel sees Megan supposedly kissing another man on her porch.
That's right.
And this, which is her therapist is
and this is the, you know, the woman she's been idealizing this whole time as the, and like you were saying, putting all her good things into her.
Right. And so she sees this and it destroys her because she sees Megan throwing it all away and she completely flips on, you know, she's in love with Megan and then she sees Megan kissing, but she's not actually kissing this man. She's actually just hugging the therapist because the therapist is consoling her. But which has all sorts of fucked up ethics. Yeah. It's like, what's he doing at her house?
But he's a Latin therapist, so it's okay.
What is he, Argentinian or something?
In the book, apparently he's supposed to be Indian, but he's clearly Latino in the movie.
Yeah. So Rachel gets angry at Megan. She gets off the train. She's super drunk, and she goes to confront Megan. But in this tunnel, she runs into Megan and Tom instead.
And she doesn't, at first she has no idea what actually happened. She like blacks out.
Right. But in reality, she thought that she ran into Tom and Anna.
Yeah.
And she thought that Anna hit her.
That's right.
But in fact, she ran into Tom and Megan and Tom hit her. And she also thought this random redhead guy, Andy was his name, was trying to attack her. But he was actually just trying to help her because these bullies came around. But anyway, you find all that out later on. Megan turns up missing. They eventually found out Megan is dead. Rachel tells Scott, Megan's husband, that Megan was having an affair with her therapist, which actually isn't true. Megan was having an affair, but not with her therapist. And Rachel and Scott try to solve the murder. And this is a part that in the movie they don't portray because in the book they have a relationship, they have sex.
Oh, what?
Yeah. I'm pretty sure
Oh my God.
And then Scott finds out that Rachel was lying to him about how Rachel knew Megan because, you know,
Whoa, okay.
You know,
that's a whole other dimension.
Yeah, and then Scott actually locks Rachel in a room in the book, apparently.
Whoa.
And Rachel thinks she's going to die. Because
she thinks Scott might have killed her.
Well, yeah, and at that point, she's like, oh, Scott killed Megan because he's this controlling guy.
You know, that was one of my complaints about the movie.
Yeah.
They actually could have done a little better job with the misdirection.
Yeah.
Because there came a point at which I was convinced it was either Justin Theroux or his wife.
Really? You were convinced? Because I didn't suspect Tom at all.
Justin? Oh, the husband?
Yeah.
Well, the reason maybe it's biased. It's just, I've seen him in enough roles, and especially because of American Psycho and stuff, because like, it had to be in my mind. But honestly, I started thinking it was his wife.
Oh.
I was like, oh, it's the wife.
Well, you know what? I never even thought about it. Like you know how you do that when you're like, oh, okay, so who did it? You know, like I don't remember
this
ever.
We were just following the trail.
I was just kind of like in the movie, in the moment, mm-hmm. and just feeling like there was just a big question mark there, you know. But if I would have thought about it, I mean, definitely Rachel, but I don't know, the movie, the trailers made it seem kind of dark, and so I think a part of me actually thought maybe Rachel did it, you know?
Yeah. I guess what, I hadn't seen the previews at all.
They made it really sinister.
I watched the previews
after. They almost made it look like a horror movie.
That's right. I watched the previews after, and I'm like, okay, they oversold the concept in the previews.
Right. So Rachel starts therapy with the therapist to check him out, I think to see if he killed Megan. Because in the book, I think she starts thinking that he killed Megan. And he actually turns out to be a good therapist, and he helps Rachel to recover her memories while she was blacked out, which I'll get more into the science in a second. Rachel recovers a memory of the night that Megan went missing, and she realizes that it wasn't Anna and Tom under the overpass. It was Megan and Tom. Right. And then she pieces all that together, and she figures, oh, it must have been Tom that killed Megan.
Right.
So then Rachel goes to Anna to tell Tom, you know, to tell Anna that Tom killed Megan. You know, why doesn't she go to the cops? I don't, right. But she goes to Anna. Tom is there. Did they talk about that in the movie? Like, why did she go to Anna and Tom's house to tell?
Yeah, this is another thing that happens in the movies, is no one ever involves the cops until it's like way
too
late.
Well, I guess they made it pretty clear that the cops weren't very supportive of Rachel.
Oh, but...
But you could go to a different cop.
Yeah, no. Well, I'm certainly not going, like, okay, the part that it was really, like, you don't confront the person you now are very certain has murdered one woman.
Yeah.
When all there is confronting that person is you, the woman, and another woman and a baby.
Right.
Like, that's a dangerous situation.
Yeah. Side note, that detective was annoying the shit out of me. The way they wrote her.
She was very one-dimensional, you know, like,
and
I doubt your story from the beginning.
Yeah. Not only that, but the way she doubted was, it was like, she was over the top.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Anyway, so Rachel goes to Anna to tell her that Tom is the murderer. Tom is there. Tom confesses to the murder, and he kind of threatens the child. So Anna pulls away because Anna's like, oh, well.
He doesn't confess, but he
doesn't?
No, he doesn't. But he clearly doesn't deny anything,
yeah.
And instead goes and implicitly threatens the child.
Right.
Yeah.
And then he attacks Rachel. In self-defense, Rachel stabs Tom with a corkscrew, which was, you know, very symbolic since she was a drunk, right?
Right. I didn't catch that.
I didn't catch that later, until later, but it makes obvious sense now, right? And then Anna, in the book as well, finishes Tom off, which is interesting, right?
Right.
And
he attacks her with a shot glass.
Okay.
He smashes a shot glass in her head, which again is also related to alcohol.
Right.
And then she's the one who stabs him through the neck with the corkscrew.
And then Anna comes over and finishes
him
off.
And like, oh, it's like, what is she going to do? Oh my God, she's digging it deeper.
Yeah. You just hear squish, squish.
Yeah.
And so when I'm watching this opening night at Cinnabar, you know, it's like that it's like a bar slash, actually, I just figured it out. Cinnabar is cinema and a bar.
And a bar, that's right.
We're learning all sorts of things. And, you know, they take out every row of chairs and they put tables in. And so it's like basically like a bar restaurant. And there were like 15 40-year-old drunk women right next to me.
Oh boy.
In the movie theater. You know, they seem like nice people.
Yes, yes, yes.
But they were being a little obnoxious, you know, like especially before the movie, like, you know, pretty.
Because they all read the book in the book club.
Pretty ruckus. You know what I mean? It was fine.
I guarantee you, this was their book club book.
Yeah.
And now they were watching the movie together.
Yeah. And they're getting a little sloshed. And then right as. right as Anna is really just kind of squishing.
Like, yeah.
Squishing it in. Yeah. They go crazy, and then one woman yells, "Here's to killing husbands!"
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's horrible.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
What do you think about that?
Well, that's just as bad as, like, grabbing him by the pussy. Like, that's horrible.
I mean, you know, I think there's like a 5-10% chance that she was being 100% ironic.
Yeah.
Which I hope that's the case, but it didn't sound like it. In the moment, I just sort of chuckled. But as I was walking out, I was like, wait a second, let's reverse the gender on that.
Yeah, you know, right.
Let's imagine a movie in which a husband is cutting the throat of his wife because she was a bad person.
Here's killing wives.
And then 10 drunk dudes are partying it up and together, and one of them stands up and says, "Here's to killing wives." I mean, ironic, even if it was, that would be.
Plus, it's a theater. Like, you're making a public announcement.
Yeah. Now, we can't just equalize things like that because the context of gender is such that it doesn't translate, you know. And I sort of get why women, if it was sort of an honest, so to speak, joke, I could see how women oppressed and put upon by men in our society, lots of manspreading, lots of mansplaining, lots of domestic violence, lots of, you know, horrible.
Well, there's that song, Earl Had to Die.
Yeah.
You know that song?
No.
They sing it at karaoke all the time.
Really?
It's like some guy, Earl, he's cheating on his wife and he's blah, blah. And in the song, she kills him with a shotgun or something.
Right.
And women love to sing it at karaoke. Right. But if there was a song like that about a...
Reverse.
Right. That would be pretty bad.
Well, so the difference here is that men kill their wives, husbands kill their wives at enormously higher rates than wives kill their husbands.
Right.
Not that wives don't kill their husbands, because they do, out of cold blood. And there are women psychopaths, absolutely. But the context of that joke is within an imbalanced gender landscape. At the same time, I don't like that joke.
Yeah.
I don't like that joke for a number of reasons. And there's so many other jokes she could have said, you know?
Yeah.
And the fact that everyone kind of laughed at it, I mean, I'm not in everyone's head.
Like, stick it to them.
Yeah. Like, stick it to men. You know what I mean? Like, it just, like, it reminds me of this time when I was taking a class in my undergrad. It was a class, for some reason, we were watching, I think it was a class on development, like human development. And we were watching sperm under the microscope, you know, and they're like, here is a healthy sperm. And it's like, you know, with its tail, like, flapping its way. And then they're like, and here is a dysfunctional sperm or something, and it's going in circles.
Uh-huh.
And the women start in the, because it was mainly nurses, there's a lot of nurses, female nurses, they chuckled a chuckle and started commenting on in such a way that made it seem like this was a gender thing. Do you know what I mean? Like it's hard to explain, but they were laughing in a way that it was like, oh, men and their
typical circular men.
It was that kind of talk. Yeah, it was totally. And I remember
going in circles,
you know, just like useless, you know, just stupid men going in circles. How pathetic of them was the kind of vibe in the room. And as one of the only males in the room, I just remember thinking, like, what a interesting way of looking at sperm. You know what I mean?
Like, they just show you a healthy one. Yeah. You know, that is something that has happened in media since the beginning, is that I don't know if it's as a reaction to the reality of men being so overbearing in the world and culture, but you know, men are portrayed largely as idiots in sitcoms and in things. So it's always like, oh, honey, you know, there's all those things. And I grew up watching that, and you kind of start feeling like, okay, maybe I need to be the doofy dude that the woman always comes to save.
Yeah.
Because that's how it's portrayed in every sitcom.
Yeah. Absolutely. Now, that's not entirely the entire media landscape. We have lots of examples of very competent men. But that's another... I mean, it's more of a reflection of society. It's not necessarily the comedian's fault.
Although, actually, you know, it's funny. The competent men in media are often because they're very good at violence.
Right, exactly.
About it.
That's exactly true.
Like, Jack Bauer's competent because he can torture people.
Right. Okay, let's talk about Megan. So we've talked about Rachel. Let's talk about Megan's story. So Megan starts out with, this is before the book starts, but they, you know, flesh out this history. Megan's brother dies in an accident when they were both teenagers. This is in the book. And this is her first trauma, and this is a significant loss. Her brother dies in an accident suddenly when they're both teenagers.
Wow.
As a teenager, or as a young woman, she falls in love with her first boyfriend, her first love, named Mac. And this is possibly fueled by her trying to get her brother back. Not sure. She has a baby with Mac. She accidentally kills her baby in the bathtub. She falls asleep with the baby on her. The baby sort of fell down and drowned. And she wakes up, and it's this totally traumatizing event. And now here we have, you know, maybe it's a total accident, but maybe it's an unconscious recreation of her brother's death. You know, these kind of things happen. Her boyfriend leaves her. Mac leaves her. And it's another recreation, just like her brother left her and just like her baby left her. So now she has brother leaving her, baby leaving her, Mac leaves her. She becomes depressed and angry. She marries Scott, who's a very controlling guy and obviously very rich as well because he has a similar humongous house and he looks like he's 25.
Right. let's put it this way. If they're not rich, they misrepresented the state of affairs in this thing.
she tries to become the model wife. She tries to become perfect for Scott. She's not really herself. She's not very genuine. You know, she's kind of putting on an act to live a life that she thinks she should be living. She's not trying to have kids anymore. Right. She says she hates babies, but of course she probably is just saying that because of a defense against her, you know, having that lost her own baby. Megan becomes very bored and lonely, and but she's really potentially just suffering from grief and trauma from her life. She gets a nannying job with Tom and Anna, who live down the street. And
my sense was that she started having an affair before the nanny job.
Oh, really?
Because she says something like, why did you even bring me there then? And he's like, well, I thought it'd be fun to have both of you there.
Right. That's right. So, okay. So somehow she starts having an affair with Tom.
With the guy next door, basically.
Right. And then she gets a nannying job there, which is just sick. I mean, just sick.
He basically... And did I get the sense, maybe it was just in the movie, like she seemed a little... No. She seemed very sexually preoccupied, like obsessed.
Right. So there were hints, if she was a real person, of histrionic personality disorder. I don't like that name. I could call it like sexual attention personality disorder. In all likelihood, as a young child, she was denied attention and she learned that a way to get attention that everyone needs, honestly, she can get it by accentuating her early cuteness and then later on her sexual nature. So there were lots of clues around that, you know, like when she meets the therapist for the, you know, or when she's talking to her therapist, she's very sexual with him, you know, the way she walks around and da 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 da. Okay, so Megan hates babies, but she's really describing. She feels abandoned by Scott because he travels a lot. That's in the book. I don't think that's in the movie. So she's being abandoned. She's abandoned by brother, by baby, by Mac, by Scott, and just kind of by Tom because Tom can't be with her all the time.
Right.
She quits her nannying job. More abandonment. Now she's the abandoner of the family. She's coldly just leaves the baby and the family.
And by the way, I knew there was an affair happening when the wife tells Tom, that she's quitting.
Yeah.
Because it's like, you know, such as Megan is quitting. And he's like, oh, yeah? And I'm like, oh, you're fucking
okay. So she goes to therapy, finally, which is good for her. In the movie, like we were talking about, she seems very seductive. Now, what histrionic people will do is deep down, they really just want attention and love. But because they don't actually trust other people, they will use sexual seduction as a way of getting attention because they don't trust that they're worthy of any attention. Mm. So she uses this, and he actually responds pretty well to it. Now,
The therapist,
yeah, because he doesn't ultimately have sex with her and doesn't really respond to her sexual comments.
He just goes over to her house and hugs her.
But in the book and in the movie, he obviously was struggling, or his approach to therapy is just not a sound approach. She shows up at his door, he lets her in, and then he goes to her house, and there's lots of touching, and although not inherently necessarily awful,
right,
it's not advised, let's just put it that way.
I mean, let me put it this way, like as a man watching the scene where she's trying to seduce him, I'm thinking, Yeah, that would be pretty tough. But then as a therapist, he started trying to shut it down, but he didn't.
Right.
You know, he was like, oh, don't do something that will make it so we can't work together. But, you know, I think someone with better training or something at that moment might have said, like, oh, we got to stop here.
Right.
I'll see you next time. We'll right. talk about this or
right.
something.
Like yeah, there's all sorts of ways of dealing with it. Like, you know, a lot of therapists will say things like, oh, you got to establish rules. You got to like say, hey, you can't do that. But that's dumb. It's like people have issues and they portray those issues in therapy and you yeah. can't, by establishing rules, you're essentially just not, you're just cutting off a whole bunch of material.
Yeah.
But when she approaches him physically or especially when she shows up at his house, it's like, you just got to be like, you know, I'm really sorry.
Right.
But, and I realize you're in crisis right now. Or, you know, a way around that would be like, let's maybe go to a restaurant or like, don't come in the house.
Right. Right.
Let's go somewhere else. Or do you have to go to the ER?
Right.
Or let me call a colleague, a female colleague of mine, and she can come over and then, right. you know, we can, like, there's ways of dealing with that,
right, right.
that, you know,
mitigate the
potential weirdness and yeah. the boundary crossings while absolutely paying attention to her and giving her right. the crisis intervention that she needs. Having said that, therapists probably should in that situation just say, I'm terribly sorry, but you're going to have to leave and yeah. we'll talk about it when you come to my next yeah. session. If you're in a crisis, you can call 911 or the crisis line. I'm really sorry about
That's
that.
Right.
Having said that, no one's ever done that to me. That's pretty rare behavior. Right. I can't imagine a client coming to my house and just knocking on the door. And all my clients know where I live because my office, yeah. we're in my office that I practice. And so
it's funny because I was about to say like, oh man, I mean, I would definitely not give my address out to my patients. And then I realized they come to your house for their therapy.
Right.
But you've never had an issue, luckily.
Never, yeah. never. It's not luckily. It's people are good and normal people.
You've never had me as a patient.
The thing is like, because of things like this in the movies, everyone assumes that clients are crazy and do horrible things.
Right.
But 99.999% of clients are just like you and me, and they're not stalkers, and they're right. not terrible people. Okay. So back to Megan. She wants Tom to leave his wife, and she calls and texts him a lot, but Anna thinks that those are calls from Rachel. Megan seems to be very attracted to unattainable men, recreating the original abandonment with her brother and her baby and Mac and kind of Scott. She's punishing herself because if she does have this history as a child of not getting enough love and attention, which there seems to be evidence of, she doesn't believe she's worthy. And mm-hmm. so she only comes at attachment from an oblique angle without really being genuine and really thinking she's worth the sort of person that would treat her well. Because Scott wasn't such a great guy. I mean, right. he's abusive and controlling.
Well, and even like the manner of sex they show up more than once is like he just meets her in the woods and they just do doggy style.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
It's very, I mean, they do have a scene in the hotel too, but like it's kind of like, what is she getting out of this?
You right. know? Right. Megan gets pregnant with Tom, and the first thing I thought was, why wasn't she using birth control, right?
Right.
I mean, she gets pregnant, you know, so if right. she's not using birth control, why would she yeah. psychologically make that choice, trying to recreate this mm-hmm. past abandonment, trying to, get attention, trying to kind of loop or rope Tom into a relationship that
right.
he doesn't really want to do.
Because he doesn't seem like the guy that would have put on a condom.
Right.
for the affair.
Her therapist advises Megan to tell her husband, Scott, the truth. Do you think this is good advice, Berto? So Megan goes to her therapist and says, I'm pregnant with Tom's baby. And then the therapist is like, well, you got to tell Scott that you're pregnant.
Yeah, that was weird because it's the same therapist had told her that Scott's behavior was unacceptable.
Right.
That was abusive behavior.
Let me side note on that for a second. I cringed when that happened. Although I could absolutely see a therapist saying that. That's not a helpful thing to say.
Okay.
You know, maybe they're just cutting corners. You need to have a larger conversation about domestic violence and control mm-hmm. and intimate partner, abuse and all that yeah. kind of stuff. And the way he said it was just like, That's unacceptable.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. It was like final judgment has been made.
Yeah,
so, I will take no context into. But anyways, so but given that he had said that, it seems it didn't seem to follow that he'd be like, oh yeah, go tell your what I've said to be a abusive boyfriend that you're pregnant with some other dudes.
Right. But you could absolutely see someone that doesn't know anything about therapy thinking that a therapist would say that.
Yeah.
You know? 'Cause I think that people think that therapists are all about like open communication.
Oh yeah, right? And ethics. Like you always got to tell the truth no matter what to everyone.
Anyone who knows anything about human beings knows that that is not necessarily true.
Right.
Complete honesty, radical honesty is a tough thing to pull off and with, you know, so anyway. Now should Megan be truthful in general? Sure. Should she just run home and tell Scott? No. I mean, it's terrible advice, it's particularly given the DV issues, right?
Well, especially like no matter what, having gone through therapy, like I don't remember a time where my therapist, who is a good therapist, told me, here's what I need you to do right now. Like there was never a directive, because if for example, the idea was that one of my things that I'm working on is trying to be more honest with my partner, then that would be a theme we would be trying to work through.
Right.
And when all of a sudden I reveal, look, I am having an affair, like in therapy, let's say I say, I'm having an affair, right? Well, then you would think that the therapist would be like, okay, well, let's talk to that. And over the next N sessions, we're going to try to deal with it. As opposed to like, well, you got to go tell your partner.
Right.
Like that, what?
Yeah. Right. Now, incidentally, just brainstorming, what I might do is say, well, how do you want to approach this? You know, I would explore it. I would never tell someone to do it.
That's right.
If I really felt compelled along those lines, I would say, you got to go to couples therapy, or Scott has to come in here and we need to like have a contained conversation about this.
In fact, wouldn't it be like, okay, my instinct right now would tell me that I might even be a little more protective of saying, you know, in my mind, I might be thinking, oh, this could unravel really fast.
Yeah.
So then maybe trying to start forming some sort of support around the situation, like you're saying, couples, things like that.
Right. Or a DV advocate or friends to be around when it happens. Yeah, absolutely. So Megan does follow the therapist's advice, tells Scott, her husband. He naturally gets angry and he hurts her. Then Megan goes to Tom for comfort and tells him that she's pregnant. And Tom tells her to have an abortion. Megan threatens to tell everyone about the affair because she's upset. Tom hits her. Now, in the book, I don't know. I tried to look this up. I don't know if they really portray the murder. I think it's just like, well, Tom killed her because blah, blah, blah. But in the book, they show it, right? They show...
In the movie.
Yeah. Or sorry, in the movie, they show it. And what did you think about that scene?
Well, okay. So it was a gruesome scene. Just imagining the horror of that situation for her.
Yeah.
Because she like gets knocked out temporarily, and then when she starts coming to, she's been dragged into what looks like, so she realizes what's about to happen, and then he's like stoning her to death. It's horrible.
Yeah.
I also thought, okay, so that gave me new information about this guy, because it's hard to imagine, quote unquote, a normal dude that's having an affair that all of a sudden is like, oh, you're pregnant. It's like, okay, fine. I'm a murderer and I'm going to like with zero compunction, bash your head in and bury your body. And like, whoa.
Right. So there's lots of psychopathic clues that we can point to diagnose Tom as a psychopath.
Yeah.
He manipulated that Machiavellian aspect that we talked about in other episodes.
He lost his job due to an ability to contain his urges.
Right. And affairs were not a problem for him.
Right. Lies compulsively.
Right. When people are close to him, they don't do so well. They don't feel close to him. You know, Rachel and him grow distant. Anna and him grow, they show like their distant sex and how it's not really working well. And the, you know, cherry on top is that he murdered somebody.
And he felt no connection to his baby.
Right.
I mean, it seems like it's like, I'm going to use my baby as like threat right now.
Right.
And manipulated very on purpose the main girl, Rachel's memories and everything.
Yeah. Can you imagine that, all of that stuff? You know, that's pretty bad. So, yeah, I would say absolutely psychopathic. In the movie, though, I liked how they made the murder scene. Not I liked the murder, but they made it seem more like a crime of passion. Mm-hmm. It started as a crime of passion, yeah. Because they get in a scuffle, he pushes her, she falls, she hits her head.
Right.
So it's unclear if they hadn't gotten to a scuffle,
if he would have killed her,
what he would have done, yeah. Right? And then once she's on the ground, then he's like, oh, okay, might as well finish it off, right? Yeah. Now, a normal person like you and me would never do anything like that. But it's unclear if he would have murdered her if the situation hadn't gone that way, right?
That's right. There were two things that happened in that scene. One of them is when she's like, okay, you know, I'm pregnant. And he's like, oh, well, congratulations. He says something like, oh, great. And she's like, no, it might be yours, right? And he's like, oh, well, then you got to get an abortion. Like, there was no debate in his head. There's like only one reality we operate in, and it's everything that's beneficial to me.
Right.
And as soon as you cross that line, well, there's only one option.
Right.
And so it seemed the same with the push. He pushes her initially as just like, ah, you're hitting me, fine. But then once he sees that she's hit her head, she might have been fine and we could have worked our way out of this, or it could have been embarrassing, but we would have eventually gotten home. Instead, he's like, oh, she hit her head. Okay, well, it's time to kill her.
Right.
Like,
yeah. There's a lot of other options available in that moment. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for instance, he could just get a divorce. I mean, him and Anna weren't really getting along at the time. So,
yeah.
He could get a divorce. He could have a child with Anna, and he could have a child with Megan. And, you know, people do that. It's not the end of the world. You don't have to kill anyone.
And I don't know if they were trying to do it on purpose, but I definitely got. When she comes to the house and confronts him and stuff like that, then I really thought, okay, he's absolutely a psychopath because he doesn't unaffected.
Yeah, he doesn't react. He's not like, he doesn't put his hands.
Yeah, he's just like, he's completely neutral.
Yeah. Okay, so analysis of the memory, let's end with that. So basically the science is that alcohol interferes with the hippocampus, which has to do with long-term memory formation. Mm-hmm. So you have short-term memory and long-term memory. These are different mechanisms of the brain. You know, your RAM and your hard drive, right?
That's right.
And so when you are extremely drunk, particularly when you drink a lot very quickly, so research shows that it's not necessarily your blood alcohol level, it's the amount of time it took to get there. So if it's a very short amount of time to get to that high level. So if you binge drink, essentially, you're much more likely to have a hippocampus malfunction, mm-hmm. which makes it so that you can remember short-term memory things. So you're walking around, someone introduces themselves to you, and you remember their name 5 minutes later. But what happens is that the next day, you don't remember any of those events.
But they weren't recorded.
They weren't recorded. So in the moment, you remember minute to minute, but they don't pass the threshold into long-term memory. So the memories are just never recorded. It's not like the memories are there and they're not accessible.
Right.
They're just not there. So therefore, you can't, through therapy particularly, recover memories that you didn't form during a blackout. Now, there's different gradients of blackout. You can have what they call brownouts and these kinds of things where your memory is impaired to a lesser degree, where you can remember bits and pieces, but you don't remember everything.
You could make an argument that that it's because she got her head hit that she forgot. You know, like you can make that argument,
but even that kind of memory loss is even less supported by science. Being hit on the head, and the hit on the head amnesia thing is ridiculous.
What? Every 80s show
I know
showed me how it works.
What did I watch? Oh, I watched Desperately Seeking Susan recently.
You mentioned that.
Yeah. Okay. So, and so another thought that people have is that it has to do with association, right? So it's like, oh, you just need to get drunk and then you remember those memories. It's not true. You've heard that before, right?
No, I haven't. Oh, that's awesome.
It's debunked. Debunked by empirical study. Now, it might be an accurate portrayal of memory loss and recovery if it's not alcohol-induced.
It's like trauma.
But trauma and dissociative. So she was suffering from PTSD as a result of the DV that she went through or some even more distant past problem. And she has dissociative mechanisms in her brain to protect her from difficult memories. Then those memories are going into long-term memory banks, but you can't access them through dissociation, and through therapy, you can recover them. And I've seen this happen. They're not necessarily repressed to the point of unconscious, but the person will avoid the memories because they're too difficult.
You know, this is a missed opportunity. I'm sure the writer probably didn't know this fact about the drunk memory stuff. But it is a missed opportunity because in the scene when Phoebe is telling her, what? That's not what happened.
Right.
This is what happened. And she starts remembering. They show the scene of what actually happened, which I think the implication is that she starts remembering how it really happened.
Right.
So it would have been actually more powerful now that I think about it if maybe she's at the therapist's office and he's like, listen, and he's explaining, when you're on alcohol, you don't have those memories. You know, he's explaining this.
Yeah.
And so we as the audience don't get that resolution. Like, it would be a lot more powerful if we kind of know what happened, because Phoebe does say, no, that's not what happened.
Right.
But we don't get to see. Like, right. We're just as confused as she is. Like,
right.
That would have been cool.
Right. Instead of having the flashbacks to make it obvious to us what, quote unquote, really happened.
And imply that she's remembering.
It's all narratively told, and they never flash back visually. And so we just like, well, was the boss right? What, you know, who's right?
Yeah.
I think that's kind of how the book actually plays it, because...
Oh, okay.
Similar to Gone Girl, you have unreliable narratives, they call them. Anyway, is alcoholism depicted accurately in this story? What do you think?
Well, she is definitely in a rut, and she has moments where she is visibly intoxicated, and you know, she is chaotic in the train, and she's a mess. You know, there's a scene where she like fills her water bottle with probably vodka or some other spirit.
Vodka.
And she seems not in control for sure. But they don't, other than that stuff, I didn't feel like, and then she went to AA once, you know, I didn't feel like they showed enough of her problems. Like, for example, she seemed functional.
Yeah.
Like, she seemed functional.
Right.
She got on the train every day, you know, and so I'm not sure how severe her alcoholism was, but she certainly was not functional to the point of being able to have a job. But
it sounded like it was severe because she was frequently blacking out.
Well, that's true. Yeah.
And so, you know, that's a lot of booze. And so I thought it was okay. It wasn't a bad depiction. I mean, as far as movies go, because it's not a movie about alcoholism.
That's
true. It's not like 48 Earth. What's that? Movie.
Leaving Las Vegas.
Yeah, it's not like that, right? It's an element, but it's not the main focus. But I thought it was a pretty good depiction of it.
I will say that it's not usual to see a movie where the protagonist is a female who's an alcoholic.
Right. And how it's sort of pathetic. I don't think there was ever a moment where it was like, oh, you go, girl, you drink.
No.
Right.
Even though it was Emily Blunt playing the character,
right.
It definitely was not glamorized.
Right.
Not in the least.
Right. All right. Well, that does it for that episode of Psychology in Seattle. Thanks for joining us. And please take care of yourself. And if you're going to be one of the dudes, if you're a dude out there, be an Andy. Come on.
Be an Andy, because you deserve it.